Okay. So, well, thank you everybody for staying here, and thanks, of course, for the opportunity to talk about some of the things that we are working in. So I was asked to give like the first sensor network talk in the workshop. So I tried to make it a bit introductory, so that probably means that for most of you this is very boring. But I will try to give you a bit of a perspective of what you can do for Dynamics with these sensor network techniques. Although among our coordinators we have much better experts to tell you the details about these things. And then I'll tell you about some alternative ways that we are trying to develop to attack these problems and some of the applications that we have been doing with this. So tensor networks have appeared in the literature several times in different contexts, but in the context I'm talking about, this is about describing quantum many body states. So the idea is that you have some system or some particles, say, that have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and they have some pattern of interactions. And then what we want to do is describing the physical states. So we start with the equilibrium states, but of course, especially here, we are not only interested in equilibrium, so in ground and thermal equilibrium states, but also we want to do some dynamics. So in general, we want to describe interesting states. And the idea is that if we want to do this exactly, well, in principle, we can do exact diagonalization, right? We set up a basis, which is a tensor product basis of all the individual bases of the components of our system. And we give all the coefficients of the state in that basis, and then we have an exact description, which we can do, but we can only do for a small number of systems, of course, of subsystems, because the dimension of this Hilbert space grows exponentially with the number of constituents, and then we need exponentially many coefficients to be able to describe any general state we want. And a pictorial representation that we use a lot in this tensor network business is this one, that, for instance, for this case where we want to describe a general state of the many-body system, we need to specify all the coefficients of this vector, and all these coefficients we can represent by a tensor, which in this language just means a multidimensional array. So it's an object which has n legs, one per individual basis, say, and this solid box represents all the coefficients. So if we would give a value for each of the legs, it would mean one index for each of the bases, and this would specify the whole state. And this, of course, is very costly. It's exponentially costly. And the idea of tensor networks, generally speaking, is that instead of considering the most general states in the Hilbert space, we reduce the set, the space where we work, to states which have some structure. So instead of having the most general coefficient, we have coefficients that can be written as a particular tensor network, as it's depicted here. So this is really a conceptual picture of a tensor network. So you have a number of smaller tensors, which has a fewer, smaller number of legs. And there are some contractions, which are represented by these lines joining the tensors. And in general, we consider states where the number of parameters is polynomial in the system size instead of exponential, as here. And well, in a way, you can think of this also as a way of constructing collective properties, like collective states, out of local small tensors, which have particular properties themselves. So the first question, of course, is why this should be useful at all, because the Hilbert space is so large, and this is just a small number of states that you can describe with this polynomial number of parameters. And, well, the intuition comes from the fact that the states we want to describe are also peculiar. They are not the most general states in the Hilbert space. So if you think of this as a picture of the Hilbert space and you fish out a state at random in there, this state is very far from a product state. So you can imagine that the product states are just a very small subset of the Hilbert space, and a random state is very far from that. It has a lot of entanglement. But we are not interested in these states in general. We are interested in the states that appear in physics, in nature. And for instance, when we use mean field theory, we are certainly reducing our search to a very reduced number of states, so to states that do not have correlations. So what we want to do is to go a bit beyond that, because we are interested in states that have correlations. But the idea is that states that appear naturally in physics, they won't be random states in the Hilbert space. They will be something which is relatively close to these little entangled states. So in general, we say that we are looking for a corner of the Hilbert space, which means we are looking for states with little entanglement. This is very vague, but a way to make this more precise is given by the area law. The area law tells us that for ground states, of local Hamiltonians, when we look at the entanglement between one part of the system and the rest, instead of having the generic entanglement that we could have that should grow with the number, also with the size of the subsystem, so if we cut the system in two with the size of the system, what we have is a growth of the entanglement which goes with the boundary between the two regions that we are splitting. And, well, intuitively, you can think of this as reflecting the locality of the interactions that is building the entanglement. And of course, this is just a hand-waving argument. But in 1D, there is a strict proof that this holds for ground states of local Hamiltonians which have a gap. And also for Hamiltonians that are critical, we know that it is not violated as much as it could. So the entanglement that these critical states have is also considerably smaller than the general one. And, well, this gives a good motivation to try to parameterize the states that we want to describe with some ingredient that reflects this kind of small entanglement. And in general, you can think of tensor networks as an ansatz which is based on entanglement. So this is a good message to take out of the whole field. So as I said, the area log is a good intuition, and there is ansatz that reflect this area log by construction. And in one dimension, this is the matrix product states, and in 2D is the PEPS, which is the natural generalization. And there are a lot of successful stories about most of all matrix product states, but also I'm making a lot of progress recently with PEPS, so finding a lot of good results for difficult problems that were difficult to solve before having these tools at hand. And also, there are algorithms to simulate time evolution with them. And before moving on, I just want to mention that there are, of course, other tensor networks that do not fulfill the area law. They are constructing to reflect other patterns of entanglement, and in particular, the critical entanglement that you have find in critical states. And these are three tensor networks, and in a more general way, MERA, which has also received a lot of attention lately from the high energy community because of this suggested representation or connection to the ADS-CFT correspondence. This is just to mention a bit of the whole field, so where things are. But what I want to talk about is time evolution. And in particular, I want to talk about time evolution with matrix product states, so in one dimension. And let me just go over the basic ideas of how you do time evolution. I said there are algorithms to do this. Let me just go over the basic ideas to construct this time evolution. So the most popular algorithms, the basic fundamental ones, simulate time evolution starting with an initial state, which is a matrix product state. And then you want to apply the evolution operator for some, say, local Hamiltonian. But even if the Hamiltonian is local, the evolution operator is an exponential of the Hamiltonian, so it's not local anymore. And you cannot apply it directly to the tensor network ansatz. So the standard, or one of the standard techniques, is to discretize this evolution in small steps. This is usually done by a Trotter decomposition. And then you have small steps of evolution, small pieces of the evolution operator. And these ones you can approximate with some local structure that sort of fits the tensor network structure itself. And then you would put things together here. You would say that this is, again, a new matrix product state with bigger tensors, so because you cannot repeat this without enlarging your tensors, and then you wouldn't be able to follow this computation with your computational resources, you need to truncate the bond dimension. So you approximate the result with another MPS and iterate this thing as many steps as you need.
Yes. So, I'm sorry, I missed the first couple of slides. Did you already explain what these diagrams mean for the general audience?
More or less. Did anybody not understand?
Able to follow this?
I tried, I was a bit
fast.
Not in
the field. I want to make sure that everybody, the point of this
probably,
program
not going to answer. But,
so, if it's unclear, I think okay. It would be a good moment for people to ask, because you're starting to flip through the diagrams very fast, and if you don't
yes.
know what they mean, and it's just...
I know. I tried to give the general idea, but, I mean, please interrupt me anytime if you are not following.
Is this general for any type of interaction?
Well, there are considerations that you have to do. What I said basically works for local Hamiltonians. You can generalize it, and there are other algorithms that work also for non-local Hamiltonians. This basic algorithm was introduced for nearest neighbor Hamiltonians. You can extend it for something which is not nearest neighbor, but it costs you more. But there are other algorithms, I will mention it very fast in a moment, that also allow you to do longer range interactions. It's not precisely the the yeah, the most the biggest problem, say.
This is not related to the MPS structure, but to the trotterization.
Yes.
The short range comes.
Yes, the pictures that I was picturing. Yes, yes. So, as I said, this is the basic algorithm that most people use. This is TBD or IDBD for infinite systems, or time-dependent DMRD. They work very similarly, and depending on how you do this truncation step, well, you get different algorithms. But I'm just giving the basic ideas here, so the basic steps, what you have to do. So if you do this, somehow you end up with a new MPS. So this, and now it changes the tensor, the colors of the tensors, because it's a different tensor now, or different tensors everywhere. It could be not translational invariant that represents your time evolved state. And now you can compute observables. So if you compute observables with MPS, well, you basically take a contraction with a ket with a bra and put, say, a local observable in between, which would be a one-side operator, and it's also a tensor. I'm not going into all the details, but please interrupt me if you want to ask out some of the meaning. So, as I said, this is not the only possibility, but there are other algorithms. In particular, there is the time-dependent variational principle, TDVP, introduced some years ago. That is, for instance, one of the possibilities that allows you to use non-local Hamiltonians. And these algorithms have been used a lot, extensively, and they all have in common, somehow, that you have an ansatz for the state and you evolve it. So you always end up with some MPS description of your time-evolved state. And the problem with this is that, well, I said before that the MPS reflect this entanglement structure in the state, and in time evolution, this can go away. So in your real state, your real physical situation, the entanglement you have in your state might grow with time. And if it grows fast, linearly with time, and we know it can do this in physically relevant situations, then your ansatz stops being good. I mean, you would need a very large bond dimension to follow with precision the evolution. There are other alternatives that people have suggested, for instance, evolving the operators instead of the states. So this was called Heisenberg picture DMRD. And this works also for mixed states. And then it won't be the physical entanglement, but there is also an entanglement quantity that limits what you can do with this, what you can follow with precision. This is called operator space entanglement entropy. And, well, there are other possibilities that give up the description as time-dependent tensors of your state, and just looks at the contraction of a tensor network to represent the time-dependent observables. It's a bit similar to a partition function, which can be represented exactly as a tensor network, and then you need the contraction to give your, say, the value of the partition function or the observables. You can do this in a real-time way. But again, you can identify that there are entanglement quantities that limit what you can do with any of these approaches. So before moving on, I have to give a positive message here, because I'm commenting more on the problems of these approaches, because I want to focus on these out-of-equilibrium situations. But there are many physical situations which are interesting and which have a lot of physical information that can be treated successfully. And actually, we heard already from Lincoln the other day about the open MPS code, open source MPS, which actually implements many of these algorithms, and you can use them for instance, time evolution, which is not very far from equilibrium. Or if you just want a moderate amount of time, you are interested in what happens to a certain time, and you can put in the computational resources to follow this with precision. The good thing is that you can sort of identify when your methods are typically failing. I also mentioned here that Uli and co-workers have very nice review recently comparing different algorithms that can deal also with these long-range interactions. And I think this is very interesting if you want to do some practical time evolution for moderate times, where you can really follow this approach of like giving an MPS description of the time-dependent state. But of course, I'm here going towards the most out-of-equilibrium scenarios where these things are limited. And in this situation, so when you are really out-of-equilibrium, it's really the entanglement growth, in one way or another, that limits what you can do with these algorithms. And one typical or physically relevant situation in which this happens is when we want to study problems of thermalization, for instance. So we can consider a one-dimensional problem where we start at zero time with some product state, so something which is not an eigenstate. And then this is very easy to write as an MPS, exactly. And then we want to evolve. And well, if the system is sort of generic, we expect this thing to thermalize. And by thermalizing, in this context, what we mean is that if you look at local observables after a long time, they will look very similar to whatever is the corresponding observable in the thermal state at the corresponding temperature to whatever energy density we had at the beginning, because it's a generic system, no further conservation laws or so on. And we know that both the initial state is very well, it's exactly written as a MPS, and the thermal state, the thermal equilibrium states, can be very well approximated also, very efficiently approximated by matrix product operators, so tensor networks. And this will be the state at infinite time. We know the state at zero time. But we also know that in this situation, the entropy in the state, if we describe the state, I mean, in the pure state, can grow linearly with time. And if the entropy grows linearly with time, the one dimension we require, because the MPS can hold an entropy which is upper bounded by the logarithm of the one dimension. So to keep a precise description of the state, we would need a one dimension, so a size of the tensors that grows exponentially with time. And this means that at the beginning we are fine, but the computational requirements grow exponentially fast. And what this is called is the entanglement barrier, because at some short time, you cannot go farther with your simulation, because you don't have computational power anymore. So this is an important, say, challenge for the tensor network community right now, to get around this limitation or to understand better all the ingredients in here, because we have this thing that at zero time we know how to describe this, at infinite time we expect to have very efficient descriptions too, but we don't know how to bridge these intermediate times and really know what's going on during these times. And this is actually linked to very fundamental questions like how long does some system to thermalize, or does it thermalize or not? And in the last years, there have been many groups trying to attack this problem, and there has been some progress in this direction, but still it's far from being solved, the situation. So what I want to tell you about is some different tools that we are trying to approach some of these questions, and to really talk about properties of the dynamics itself without simulating the whole time evolution. But before, and so that I don't get kicked out of the program today, just let me mention what you can do for open systems. So some of the things are common to the things I mentioned before, but just a bit of what people can do for open system dynamics. So one possibility is to use this pure state evolution, as I mentioned before, to describe the whole system plus bath, right? And if you can do this, that's great, because then, in principle, you can access to everything as far as you are in one of the situations where you can safely use the methods, or you can identify the interesting physics up to the times which you can follow. One way of doing this is, for instance, by mapping a kind of system interacting with a standard non-interacting bath to a chain, and this has been done by many people, and also we work on this together with Ines. And then you can apply standard matrix flux state tensor network techniques. Of course, this is only possible in some cases, only if your system that you're interested in is very small and the bath is non-interacting, otherwise everything gets much more complicated and you have to adapt the techniques and it's not very clear how much you could do. A more general situation, at least more general in the sense of the many-body perspective, could be that you have a many-body open system that is interacting with a bath, and then you want to describe the density operator. Another possibility, again, is to go to this limit using quantum trajectories and using the MPS techniques to do this. And this has been applied by many people, and in particular, Andrew has a nice review on well, the whole method, and in particular, how to use MPS for this. And oops, this went a bit faster than I wanted. So the other possibility is just giving the tensor network description of the density operator from the very beginning, and doing, so for instance, master equations with MPO, a density operator. This implies, I'm already saying it, using a matrix product operator to describe your density matrix. And well, matrix flow operator is basically the same as an MPS, and MPS is here. So this particularization of the generic tensor that I mentioned before, two states that have this kind of chain of tensors, one after the other. The same thing can work for operators, because we can just write operators in a tensor product basis and keep operators for which the coefficients in this product basis are just of the form of a matrix product state. It's only in the space of operators. And this works, actually it's exact for local Hamiltonians, and even if they are not local, we know very good approximations. I already did some pictures that imply this for some approximations to the time evolution before, so we can use it for this. But what I'm saying here is for density operators, then there is something else to be taken into account. Because if we want to use this for the density operators as an ansatz, then we need some properties. So it's not as general as in the case of pure states, where any pure state, any MPS, gives us a valid physical state as far as we normalize it. If we want to describe with these density operators, then we need some properties. We need that the density operator is Hermitian, that it is normalized, and that it is positive. So one question when we deal with tensors is whether we can impose the physical properties with just the local tensors. Because if things become global, then we lose the advantage that we have from describing the thing with small local tensors. And well, hermeticity is not a problem. I'm just going a bit fast because I'm taking too long. But I'm happy to give you more details about these things if anybody is interested. So hermeticity is fine. And trace one is sort of a contraction of the tensors. It's also more or less fine. But positivity is not, because positivity is not a local property. So to judge whether a matrix is positive or not, you don't have any other choice but diagonalizing it and seeing if it has negative eigenvalues. And of course, you cannot diagonalize an NPO of an n-body system if n is larger than, say, 20, if you are lucky. But there is some way of going around this, which is what's called the purification. So instead of using directly an NPO ansatz for the density matrix, we can use an MPS ansatz for a purification of the density matrix, such that we introduce ancillary systems, we assume that the state of the system plus ancilla is an MPS, and then we trace out the ancilla, which in these pictures means connecting legs, and then we get something with this ladder kind of structure. But if we would look at two of these guys together, this is an NPO again. It's only a particular set of NPOs, and it's positive by construction. And this is the purification, and you can also work with them in this way. And well, I lost a reference here, but I'll actually link on together with Simone Montangero also. They have recently also a sort of review about how you can use the different algorithms with these ansatz. This is all what I wanted to say about open systems. So now I want to tell you again about this question that I mentioned before. So how to introduce some other tools that, without simulating the whole dynamics, let us figure out some properties of the dynamics using the tensor network techniques. And one thing that we have tried lately with these ideas is finding operators that evolve the slowest. And what this means is that if we consider a system which doesn't have any obvious conserved quantities, we wouldn't have local conserved operators, things that commute with the Hamiltonian exactly. But maybe we have something which is almost local or almost conserved or both. And this could give us a reason to have very slow time scales. So one way to ask this question is to look at Heisenberg evolution and ask ourselves which are the operators that have the smallest commutator with the Hamiltonian. Because those will be the ones that evolve the slowest. And to solve this question, one can use exact diagonalization only for a small system, or you can use also tensor network tools by modeling these operators with matrix product operators, as I was saying before, and then trying to solve this kind of minimization. And the meaning of an operator that has a very small commutator with the Hamiltonian can be connected with some dynamics in this way. So there are some technical problems in solving this thing. For instance, we want to minimize this thing, which is an operator, so we want to minimize some norm. And if it is zero, it's okay, any norm we take. But we cannot minimize efficiently any norm we want. So the one that we can minimize is Frobenius norm, so it's the trace of the square of the operator. And that doesn't allow us to say set a bound on thermalization times of any of this on this observable on any initial state. But it allows us to say something. So we call this lambda is what we call this commutator, and we find this minimization. So we find some operator with a given support. So this would be our system, and say that this represents our operator, which actually we take of the form of an NPO. And we find an operator with a given support that has a very small commutator. And okay.
And how big do you typically? I mean, there's of course a class of operators, say M, within which you perform this operation.
Yes.
How big do you take this class?
It depends on the problem. So in our first study, which was in this paper that we were doing translational invariant systems, we did exact diagonalization up to 11.
Mm-hmm.
But then we took with the NPO, we went to several tens of sites.
Also, as the support of the operator.
The support of the operator. Yeah, the system was infinite.
Yeah.
Because basically, yeah, of course, this is a good point. No, because, yeah, of course, if your operator goes all over the system, you have the Hamiltonian and all the powers of the Hamiltonian itself is an NPO, and you will have all these commutators which don't tell you anything interesting about these local conservation rules. So here the idea is that the system is infinite, but if you take an operator with a finite support, then the commutator is only supported on this support plus the boundaries, say. And this is the thing that you optimize. So what you can construct then, if you find this operator, is a sort of a high temperature state, something which is almost maximally mixed, plus some inhomogeneity, which is actually the operator. And then you can bound the time this thing takes to thermalize. And this is bounded basically by the inverse of the square root of this commutator. So if you find something which is very, very small here, it will require a very, very long thermalization time. But in some cases, if this is not so small, it won't give you something beyond, it goes to be the system with so the size of your subsystem. Anyway, at least there is this connection to times. And
sorry,
as I said,
that was a little fast at the very end.
Yes, sorry. Yeah, this was a bit technical, and I didn't want to. So what I'm saying is that it's not immediate that getting an operator that minimizes this quantity is very slow. Because okay, one thing is that it minimizes this commutator for the operator at zero time, right? But then it starts evolving. So the thing that will evolve the operator next will go with the commutator of the evolved operator itself, which might be different. So it's the slowest evolving at short times, but it doesn't mean that it's the slowest at long times. So you don't have an immediate implication in some thermalization property. But you can construct one by constructing this kind of very mixed state that contains a part of this operator. These operators, we choose them to have zero trace. So this basically allows you to it's a bit technical, but I can give you the details of the derivation later.
Okay, so when you say numerically with exact diagonalization, did you use local Lindblad operators or global Lindblad operators?
No, there are no Lindblad operators here.
There's
this is
no
just
Lindblad
a closed. It's a closed system. Yeah, let me repeat the setup maybe again. So we consider here an infinite system, and it has a local Hamiltonian typically,
yeah.
And then you ask yourself whether there is an operator with a finite support that has a very small commutator with a Hamiltonian. There are a number of approximations that we do in here, but that's basically the idea.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Okay, again, here is where the most technical details about these implications are. I just want to mention that there is an implication about a thermalization time, at least, in this quantity. So we first apply this to a transitional invariant model, but what I want to tell you in the remaining, say, 5 minutes is that you can also use it to study other systems that potentially contain these very long scale, so long time scales. And the first thing we applied, or the second thing we applied it to, was an MBL scenario. So the many body localization scenario, you all know Anderson localization, where single particle model, so single particle states get localized because of disorder. And the MBL scenario is when you also have interactions that go against the tendency of this order to localize the states. But there might be a regime where the interactions are not very strong, or the disorder is strong enough, where the many body eigenstates have localized themselves. And this has become, you see, there has been a lot of effort in this, a lot of studies of this kind of scenario in the last years. And actually, with tensor networks, one of the things is that you don't run into this fast growth of entanglement. For instance, when you do quenches, you can do a lot of things. There is even more things that you can do with tensor networks. I don't have time to tell you all what people have tried. Yeah.
NBL typically has a logarithmic increase of entanglement. Exactly. So to start with, you don't have this big problem of...
Exactly. This is one of the success stories that I mentioned here. It's not the only one, because it also has the property that you can basically diagonalize the full Hamiltonian with an efficient, quantum circuit, and you can model this with a tensor network, and people have been constructing these tensor networks to diagonalize the full Hamiltonian, and there's a lot of things that you can try. I couldn't, if I wanted to go over all the things that people have developed in the last years, with or without tensor networks, about this problem. Still, it's not completely understood what's the transition from the NBL side to the ergodic side and so on. So people are still looking at properties of these scenarios. So the reason why it might be good to look at these slow operators in this scenario is that, again, here you have an infinite chain, but it's disordered. So there's a random... I didn't mention the model because I wanted to be pretty general, but if there is sort of a standard model of NBL that people have looked at with spin chains, and this is a Heisenberg model with random magnetic field. And at least numerically for finite systems, this is well understood, that for some value of the magnetic field or the strength of disorder, the magnetic field is really the disorder here, you have localization. So it's really the standard model to try all these things and to understand what's going on in the system. So this is the model we looked at, and this is an infinite chain, so spin one half sides, and there's a random field in each of them. And the idea with this method is that you take a window of some support M, and this corresponds to some disorder realization. There are some values of the field there. And then you do this for other windows, and of course at the end you will need to average over disorder realizations if you want to say something about the properties of the system. So if you are on the ergodic side, so very, very small disorder, you would expect something like what happens in a transitional invariant system, where the slowest operator you have has some kind of almost flat profile. But if you are in the NBL side, so if you are in the localized side, then there is an effective description, so there's an emergent integrability, where there is an effective Hamiltonian written in terms of what are called L-bits, which these tau sets are basically like sigma set matrices, so the Hamiltonian commutes with a whole set of spin, effective spin operators, and actually these guys are localized in terms of the real space ones. And exponentially localized, and they all commute with Hamiltonian. This is what I said. So if we would take a window that contains a significant part of this guy, we would see something like an exponentially localized operator there that gives you a very small commutator. And because the commutator will be what you cut out, this should decrease exponentially with your system size. And, we are not the only ones to look at this property. But just to show you some of the results, actually you see this, that if you are in the small disorder regime, this commutator decays as a power law with the support, which is sort of what you find in the transitional invariant case. But if you go to large disorder, you see that this decay is exponential. So although the plots do not look so different, you have to see that here the horizontal scale is logarithmic and here is not. But this is not the whole story. Because once you have optimized this, you have an MPO that represents this operator, which is slow. And then you can look at what is inside the MPO and analyze how localized it is or not. Looking at, for instance, how important components with different support. And if you X-ray these operators, you find that in the ergodic side, you have something which is almost flat, as I was saying before. But in the very strong disorder case, you have something which is very peaked, very localized. And this was, for instance, this case is for a single realization of the disorder for a 40 site, so support of 40 sites. This is not the whole story. There is much more information, actually, in the statistics of these commutators. But I don't have time to tell you all this, so just mention that this is sensitive to the appearance of rare regions. And we can see this in the statistics of these guys. There are other systems that can have these slow dynamics, and this is just the last minute. I want to tell you this very fast. So this is something that is ongoing work. So and this is actually an open question, whether you can find this kind of localization in systems that do not have disorder. And there have been some models proposed for this localization. Well, this is just an example, but let me just say that it's not clear, the question. Some numerical studies are not conclusive. So, for instance, with these proposals, it seems that in long times, everything would thermalize anyway. It just takes very long. And, well, there is an inspiration coming from classical systems to suggest models that have that might have these kind of properties. And in classical systems, people from statistical mechanics, they look at, they try to explain the glass transition, so how some systems become glassy, and then they show a very dramatic slowdown of the dynamics. And there is this family of models that can explain that, or try to explain that, by not the landscape of energy of the possible configurations, but how the dynamics from one configuration to the next is constrained. So that some configurations can go to some others or not. And this appeared already in Hans-Peter's talk or discussion after the talk yesterday. There was this mention of this constrained PXP model or facilitated model that people realize in Rydberg-Atoms, at least in some regime. And here is the same idea. So this is one of these models where, for instance, you could imagine that you might have a classical model where spins can flip, but a spin can only flip if the neighbor, if one of the neighbors, say the left neighbor, is up, and it cannot flip in other case. And well, I don't have time to explain you all the details. I'm happy to give you more about this model later. But the idea is that with some of these models, it's shown that they exhibit this kind of dynamical transitions in the way the equilibrium state is reached. And well, the question is, can you have the same effects, this kind of slowdown and very slow dynamics, maybe lack of thermalization, if you promote these models to being quantum? And there are papers recently that suggest that this might be the case, but they are based on numerical studies for small systems, yes?
So it's only neighbor to one side, not the other side?
There are two different, there are different models. This is just one of them. It's called the East model because it just looks to one side. So it's facilitated by just one neighbor. There is also the symmetric one where it's either one is facilitating. And then there is the PXP model. That's a different one. It doesn't have this kind of transition where it's both of them have to be in a given state to allow the flip of the middle spin. They're different models. So the one I'm picturing here is called the East model. And with some rate, you can flip to one or to zero, but only if your left neighbor, say, is up.
OK, the ones that look to both sides, that's quantum cellular atomic, right?
These are classical models. So this is the East model. There is another one where you would add to these transitions also the ones that are facilitated by the right neighbor. And this is called the FA model, Fredrickson-Andersen model.
Classical version?
That's a classical one. Yeah, these are classical.
So the only difference between that and elementary cellular automata is that it's continuous time rather than discrete time, right?
These are continuous time, yes.
It's continuous time.
But these are classical models. So they describe a system where the equilibrium configuration is trivial, is that of a set of non-interacting spins at some temperature.
So what was the name of the one to the right and left that's classical
FA.
For continuous time? FA?
FA model, yeah. Fredrickson-Andersen.
Fredrickson-Andersen, thank you.
And this is called East model, which is just one half of it. And so in a way, the FA model is sort of complementary in the constraints, so the kind of transitions that are allowed are complementary to the ones in the PXP. And these models, people use them to study what happens to the trajectories that move from one configuration to another. And the kind of things you want to study is not the equilibrium, because the equilibrium is sort of trivial, but it's how the dynamics becomes very slow, because, for instance, if you have very few excitations, then it becomes very difficult for a spin to flip because it has no neighbors, right? So then there is this kind of dynamical transition. I'm not explaining all the parameters here because I don't have the time. I'm already over the limit imposed by the rules. But anyway, I'm happy to tell you more about this project. We have actually, so this is a collaboration that I wanted to mention this precisely because this is a collaboration that we started with Juan Garrahan actually here a few months ago. And we have done a study using MPS of the classical models because they have a map to a quantum Hamiltonian, and then you can look at the ground states and study these transitions. So we have recently completed this. But what we are doing now is actually to explore this quantum promotion of the model with these slow operators techniques. And the first preliminary results show us that actually you see something consistent with what they are saying, that depending on the parameters that you put in the model, you see this transition from something that goes as a power law for the commutator to something that really would go exponentially. This is, as I said, ongoing work, but yeah, that it looks a nice application. This is really everything that I wanted to tell you about. So basically, the message is that you can use distance networks in a lot of ways to do time evolution. And typically, you have these limitations depending on what you want to do. And if you want to do global quenches, then you either limit yourself to short times or need to look for some alternative perspectives. And this is what we are trying to do with the slow operators. But as I said, we are applying to different things. So thank you for your attention.
I have a question and a comment. I mean, you raised the question whether there's MBL without disorder. Uh-huh. And I think this question can be positively answered because uh-huh. you can map any disorder to an interacting system which also is disorder. So I think this can be done.
Okay.
So at least on principle ground, uh-huh. whether it's practical or not, it's maybe a different question. The second question I have, that was a comment, the question I have is, concerning the slowly evolving operators. So one thing which I'm trying to make a connection with is something which we have done in the past, is that if you have an operator which is local, but it's part of a conserved quantity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not it's a part of a globally conserved quantity. Then mm-hmm. We also found that the entanglement entropy only grows logarithmically in time.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, the first question is when you say slow operators, data would also correspond to a logarithmic increase in entanglement entropy or even less than that?
Okay, and our perspective here is different.
Mm-hmm. And the second question is there any connection to that?
To this growth of entanglement. I mean, it's not direct that you can connect one thing to the other because the setup is different, right? So in this logarithmic growth of entanglement, you are looking at a state that evolves.
With operator space entanglement.
So, and you say that this one grows
logarithmically.
I don't know if there is a direct connection. Yes, yes, I understand.
But some of them do.
Mm-hmm.
Never really understood. I mean, there's
okay.
Why? But
I mean, I don't know honestly. So we are trying now to understand better what happens in this these model ones.
Can you say about your operators how the operator space entanglement entropy would grow in as a function of time?
I don't think we can.
Okay,
so because what we do is we optimize them with some bound dimension,
uh-huh.
and then we don't evolve them. We just look at the commutator. As I said, this tells you something at zero time, and it tells you something about these maximally mixed states with some inhomogeneity. But we didn't look at the operator itself as it would evolve. But this is actually a very good question. Like, for instance, now we are trying to understand better this last result I was mentioning. We are trying to understand better what is going on in this model, because in here it's also easier to explore all the possibilities than in the disorder case, where you have to average over disorder. And this is actually one of the questions. What is the dynamics there? Can we connect the slow operators to something which is more dynamical than just this maximal mix? So that could actually be a very good question to ask.
Everyone's so hungry, no wrinkle. You just cut me off when I go too long. Okay. So, but it seems like you're making equivalent, you know, something about disorder and lack, or let's say MBL and lack of thermalization, but I'm not sure if I agree with that equivalence. I mean, I think, you know, A implies B, but B doesn't imply A.
I didn't mean that they are the same thing. I just said that these kind of tools might be very useful for systems that we suspect might have some reason for a very, very slow time scale.
So even lack of thermalization, you might find in a system that does not display a volume law, for example. So like I have.
Can you say that again?
Even lack of thermalization, you may find in a system that does not display a volume law, right? Because mm-hmm. MBL, you know, is a volume law.
No. Yes, I'm not saying that this is the only place that you will find.
I have an example myself that I'm, mm-hmm. I'm writing up. So and so I was sort of surprised that I've just, it's just kind of a comment, and maybe you have a response to it, but I've been surprised at models I've found, if I take like a tiny step past the models we've been doing, that don't fall neatly into categories of integral versus chaotic, or, you know, MDL versus, you know, something else, or volume versus area loss. Like, we have a lot of binaries right now that we have in tensor networks, and I'm kind of finding models that don't fall into those binary classifications. Have you had a similar experience with any particular models, or?
Not directly like that, but for instance, the MBL case is one case where there is an intermediate regime, right? And it's just an example. And there are these translational invariant models. For instance, the reason we started all this business was because we were trying to push the time evolution for longer times. So we had this different way of looking at time-dependent observables. We found these cases where without an evident reason for lack of thermalization, we had some states that didn't seem to thermalize in the way that other states were doing without any clear reason. So now it seems clear that for that model, there is some not integrability, but there are some kind of special states that do not fulfill ETH, and that might be a reason for these slow time scales that we were observing. And what we developed with this, or we were trying, was to develop a tool where you don't need to follow the whole evolution, and it can still tell you something about the dynamics that you don't know from other techniques. So the goal is actually to be able to explore different models that show different properties and be able to say something that you don't know.
And so exactly, PXP has those special states.
I know, this is next.
Lots of things known about them. There's even exact ones you can write.
I know. This is actually one of the states the systems we are looking at.
So I sort of suspect that there's a large class of models, you know, that are going to fall into those in-between categories that will change how we think about this.
Yes.
And any thoughts on integrability versus chaos in the many-body sense in these models and how you can...
I mean, with these tools, that's not easy to address. I mean, if it is... Okay, there is one way, but it's not completely easy, or something that we have discussed also. So we took a lot of steps to simplify the problem in here, but in principle what you can do is also to say that your operator that has some finite support is actually the translational invariant superposition of all this. I mean, all the translations of this finite support. And then you can still do the optimization, but it's much more costly. But this should give you access to local conserved quantities. So if there is really an integrability, at some point you should detect it in that way. And okay, we did some tests for the easing model, say at the beginning when we were doing exact normalization, and you would see clearly that the conserved quantities would appear for the finite supports. But doing this with the whole tensor network technique is a bit more costly. So there was some work on this by Lessig Motrunig and his student, where they actually did a bit the translational invariant setting, and it worked, but it's more costly. So I think it's a tool, but it takes a bit of effort, so it doesn't come for free.
Good. Well, let's thank Marie Carmen again.